Chapter 5, True Believers and the Unspeakable Chautauqua. From start to finish, school as we know it is a tale of true believers and how they took the children to a land far away. All of us have a tiny element of true believer in our makeups. You have only to reflect on some of your own wild inner urges and the lunatic gleam that comes into your eyes on those occasions to begin to understand what might happen if those impulses were made a permanent condition. Gatto provides this quote by Joanne Brown. A very small group of young psychologists around the turn of the century were able to create and market a system for measuring human talent that has permeated American institutions of learning and influenced such fundamental social concepts as democracy, sanity, justice, welfare, reproductive rights, and economic progress. In creating, owning, and advertising this social technology, the testers created themselves as professionals. From The Definition of a Profession, The Authority of Metaphor in the History of Intelligence Testing by Joanne Brown. And this from Charles H. Thurber. I have undertaken to get at the facts from the point of view of the businessmen, citizens of the community who, after all, pay the bills, and therefore have a right to say what they shall have in their schools. From an address at the annual meeting of the National Education Association, July 9, 1897, Charles H. Thurber. The self-interested have had a large hand in conceiving and executing 20th century schooling. Yet, once that said, self-interest isn't enough to explain the zeal in confining other people's children in rooms, locked away from the world, the infernal zeal which, like a toadstool, keeps forcing its way to the surface in this business. Among millions of normal human beings professionally associated with the school adventure, a small band of true believers has been loose from the beginning. Brothers and sisters whose eyes gleam in the dark, whose heartbeat quickens at the prospect of acting as change agents for a purpose beyond self-interest. For true believers, children are test animals. The strongest belt in the engine of schooling is the strand of true belief. True believers can be located by their rhetoric. It reveals a scale of philosophical imagination which involves plans for you and me. All you need to know about Mr. Laszlo, whose timeless faith song is cited in the front of this book, is that the we he joins himself to, the masters who manipulate, doesn't really include the rest of us except as objects of the exercise. Here is a true believer in full gallop. School history is crammed with wild-eyed orators lurking just behind the lit stage, like Hugo Munsterberg. Munsterberg was one of the people who was in on the birth of 20th century mass schooling. In 1892, a recent emigre to America from Wilhelm Wundt's Laboratory of Physiological Psychology at Leipzig in Saxony, he was a Harvard professor of psychology. Munsterberg taught his students to look at schools as social laboratories suitable for testing theory, not as aggregates of young people pursuing their own purposes. The St. Louis Exposition of 1904 showcased his ideas for academicians all over the world, and the popular press made his notions familiar to upper middle classes horrified by the unfamiliar family ways of immigrants, eager to find ways to separate immigrant children from those alien practices of their parents. Munsterberg's particular obsession lay in quantifying the mental and physical powers of the population for central government files, so policymakers could manage the nation's human resources efficiently. His students became leaders of the standardization crusade in America. Munsterberg was convinced that racial differences could be reduced to numbers, equally convinced it was his sacred duty to the Aryan race to do so. Aryanism crackled like static electricity across the surface of American university life in those days. its implications part of every corporate board game and government bureau initiative. One of Munsterberg's favorite disciples, Lillian Wald, became a powerful advocate of medical incursions into public schools. The famous progressive social reformer wrote in 1905, "It's difficult to place a limit upon the service which medical inspection should perform. Is it not logical to conclude that physical development should so far as possible be demanded?" 1 year later, immigrant public schools in Manhattan began performing tonsillectomies and adenoidectomies in school without notifying parents. The New York Times of June 29, 1906, reported that, quote, "frantic Italians, many armed with stilettos, stormed three schools, attacking teachers and dragging children from the clutches of the true believers into whose hands they had fallen." Think of a conscience which would ascribe to itself the right to operate on children at official discretion, and you will know beyond a doubt what a true believer smells like. Even a cursory study of the history of the school institution turns up true belief in rich abundance. In a famous book, The Proper Study of Mankind, paid for by the Carnegie Corporation of New York and the Russell Sage Foundation, the favorite principle of true believers since Plato makes an appearance, quote, "A society could be completely made over in something like 15 years. The time it takes to inculcate a new culture into a rising group of youngsters," close quote. Despite the spirit of profound violence hovering over such seemingly bloodless abstract formulas, this is indeed the will-o'-the-wisp pursued throughout the 20th century in forced schooling, not intellectual development, not character development, but the inculcation of a new synthetic culture in children. One designed to condition its subjects to a continual adjusting of their lives by unseen authorities. It is true that numerically, only a small fraction of those who direct institutional schooling are actively aware of its ideological bent. But we need to see that without consistent generalship from the knowledgeable group in guiding things, the evolution of schooling would long ago have lost its coherence, degenerating into battles between swarms of economic and political interests, fighting over the treasure house that hermetic pedagogy represents. One of the hardest things to understand is that true believers, dedicated ideologues, are useful to all interests in the school stew by providing a salutary continuity to the enterprise. Because of the predictable greed embedded in this culture, some overarching guardian vision, one indifferent to material gain, seems necessary to prevent marketplace chaos. True believers referee the school game, establishing its goals, rules, penalties. They negotiate and compromise with other stakeholders. And strangely enough, above all else, they can be trusted to continue being their predictable, dedicated, selfless selves. Pragmatic stakeholders need them to keep the game alive. True believers need pragmatists as cover. Consider this impossibly melodramatic if you must. I know myself that parts of my story sound like leaves torn from ragtime. But from start to finish, this is a tale of true believers and how by playing on their pipes, they took all the children away. One dependable signal of a true believer's presence is a strong passion for everyone's children. Find nonstop abstract interest in the collective noun children, the kind of love Pestalozzi or Froebel had, and you've flushed the priesthood from its lair. Eric Hoffer tells us the prototype true believer is a schoolteacher. Mao was a schoolteacher. So was Mussolini. So were many other prominent warlike leaders of our time, including Lyndon Johnson. In Hoffer's characterization, the true believer is identified by inner fire, a burning conviction we have a holy duty to others. Lack of humor is one touchstone of true belief. The expression true believer is from the 5th century book City of God, occurring in a passage where St. Augustine urges holy men and women to abandon fear and embrace their sacred work fervently. True belief is a psychological frame you'll find useful to explain individuals who relentlessly pursue a cause, indifferent to personal discomfort, indifferent to the discomfort of others. All of us show a tiny element of true belief in our makeup, usually just enough to recognize the lunatic gleam in the eye of some purer zealot when we meet face to face. But in an age which distances us from hand-to-hand encounters with authority, removing us electronically, bureaucratically, and institutionally, the truly fanatical amongst us have been granted the luxury of full anonymity. We have to judge their presence by the fallout. Horace Mann exemplifies the type. From start to finish, he had a mission. He spoke passionately at all times. He wrote notes to himself about, quote, breaking the bond of association among working men, close quote. In a commencement harangue at Antioch College in 1859, he said, "Be ashamed to die until you have won some victory for humanity," close quote. A few cynical critics snipe at Mann for lying about his imaginary school tour of Prussia, which led to the adoption of Prussian schooling methodologies in America. But those cynics miss the point. For the great ones, the goal is everything. The end justifies any means. Mann lived and died a social crusader. His second wife, Mary Peabody, paid him this posthumous tribute. He was all afire with purpose. Al Shanker, longtime president of the American Federation of Teachers, said in one of his last Sunday advertisements in the New York Times before his death, quote, "Public schools do not exist to please Johnny's parents. They do not even exist to ensure that Johnny will one day earn a good living at a job he likes," close quote. No other energy but true belief can explain what Shanker might have had in mind. A beautiful example of true belief in action crossed my desk recently from the alumni magazine of my own alma mater, Columbia University. Written by the director of Columbia's Institute for Learning Technologies, a bureau at Teachers College, this mailing informed graduates that the education division now regarded itself as bound by a contract with posterity. Something in the tone warned me against dismissing this as customary institutional gas. Seconds later, I learned with some shock that the Teachers College felt obligated to take a commanding role in maintaining the planet. The next extension of this strange idea was even more pointed. Teachers College now interpreted its mandate, I was told, as one compelling itself to distribute itself all over the world and to teach every day 24 hours a day, close quote. To gain perspective, try to imagine the University of Berlin undertaking to distribute itself among the 50 American states, to be present in this foreign land 24 hours a day, swimming in the minds of Mormon children in Utah and Baptist children in Georgia. Any university intending to become global like some nanny creature spawned in Bacon's ghastly utopia New Atlantis is no longer simply in the business of education. Columbia's Teachers College had become an aggressive evangelist by its own announcement, an institution of true belief selling an unfathomable doctrine. I held its declaration in my hand for a while after I read it, thinking. Let me underline what you just heard. Picture some UN thought police dragging reluctant Serbs to a loudspeaker to listen to Teachers College rant. Most of us have no frame of reference in which to fit such a picture. Narcosis, in the face of true belief, is a principal reason the disease progressed so far through the medium of forced schooling, without provoking much major opposition. Only after a million homeschooling families and an equal number of religiously oriented private school families emerged from their sleep to reclaim their children from the government in the 1970s and 1980s, in direct response to an epoch of flagrant social experimentation in government schools, did true belief find ruts in its road. Columbia, where I took an undergraduate degree, is the last agency I would want maintaining my planet. For decades, it was a major New York slumlord, indifferent to maintaining its own neighborhood, a territory much smaller than the globe. Columbia has been a legendary bad neighbor to the community for the 40 years I've lived near my alma mater. So much for its qualifications as planetary guardian. Its second boast is even more ominous. I mean that the goal of intervening in mental life all over the world, teaching every day 24 hours a day. Teaching what? Shouldn't we ask? Our trouble in recognizing true belief is that it wears a reasonable face in modern times. Take a case reported by the Public Agenda Foundation, which produced the first ever survey of educational views held by teachers' college professors. To their surprise, the authors discovered that the majority of 900 randomly selected professors of education interviewed did not regard a teacher's struggle to maintain an orderly classroom or to cope with disruptive students as major problems. The education faculty was generally unwilling to attend to these matters seriously in their work, believing that widespread alarm among parents stemming from worry that graduates couldn't spell, couldn't count accurately, couldn't sustain attention, couldn't write grammatically or write at all, was only caused by views of life outmoded and mistaken. Close quote. While 92% of the public thinks basic reading, writing, and math competency is, quote, absolutely essential, according to an earlier study by Public Agenda, education professors did not agree. In the matter of mental arithmetic, which a large majority of ordinary people, including some schoolteachers, consider very important, about 60% of education professors think cheap calculators make that goal obsolete. The word passion appears more than once in the report from which these data are drawn, as in the following passage, quote, education professors speak with passionate idealism about their own, sometimes lofty vision of education and the mission of teacher education programs. The passion translates into ambitious and highly evolved expectations for future teachers, expectations that often differ dramatically from those of parents and teachers now in the classroom. The soul of a teacher is what should be passed on from teacher to teacher, a Boston professor said with some intensity. You have to have that soul to be a good teacher. Close quote. It's not my intention at this moment to recruit you to one or another side of this debate, but only to hold you by the back of the neck as Uncle Bud, who you'll meet up ahead, once held mine and point out that this vehicle has no brake pedal. Ordinary parents and students have no way to escape this passion. Twist and turn as they might, they will be subject to any erotic curiosity inspired love arouses. In the harem of true belief, there is scant refuge from the Sultan's lusty gaze. School wreaks havoc on human foundations in at least 8 substantive ways, so deeply buried few notice them, and fewer still can imagine any other way for children to grow up. 1. The first lesson schools teach is forgetfulness, forcing children to forget how they taught themselves important things like walking and talking. This is done so pleasantly and painlessly that the one area of schooling most of us would agree has few problems is elementary school, even though it is there that the massive damage to language making occurs. Jerry Farber captured the truth over 30 years ago in his lapidary metaphor, Student as Nigger, and developed it in the beautiful essay of the same name. If we force children to learn to walk with the same methods we use to force them to read, a few would learn to walk well in spite of us, most would walk indifferently without pleasure, and a portion of the remainder would not become ambulatory at all. The push to extend daycare further and further into currently unschooled time importantly assists the formal 12-year sequence, ensuring utmost tractability among first graders. 2. The second lesson schools teach is bewilderment and confusion. Virtually nothing selected by schools as basic is basic. All curriculum is subordinate to standards imposed by behavioral psychology, and to a lesser extent, Freudian precepts compounded into a hash with third force psychology centering on the writings of Carl Rogers and Abraham Maslow. None of these systems accurately describes human reality, but their lodgment in university business seven-step mythologies makes them dangerously invulnerable to common sense criticism. None of the allegedly scientific school sequences is empirically defensible. All lack evidence of being much more than superstition cleverly hybridized with a body of borrowed facts. Pestalozzi's basic simple-to-complex formulation, for instance, is a prescription for disaster in the classroom, since no two minds have the same, quote, simple starting point. And in the more advanced schedules, children are frequently more knowledgeable than their overseers. Witness the wretched record of public school computer instruction when compared to self-discovery programs undertaken informally. Similarly, endless sequences of so-called subjects delivered by men and women who, however well-meaning, have only superficial knowledge of the things whereof they speak, is the introduction most kids get to the liar's world of institutional life. Ignorant mentors cannot manage larger meanings, only facts. In this way, schools teach the disconnection of everything. 3. The third lesson schools teach is that children are assigned by experts to a social class and must stay in the class to which they have been assigned. This is an Egyptian outlook, but its Oriental message only begins to suggest the bad fit it produces in America. The natural genius of the United States, as explored and set down in covenants over the first two-thirds of our history, has now been radically degraded and overthrown. The class system is reawakened through schooling. So rigid have American classifications become that our society has taken on the aspect of caste, which teaches unwarranted self-esteem and its converse, envy, self-hatred, and surrender. In class systems, the state assigns your place in a class, and if you know what's good for you, you come to know it, too. 4. The fourth lesson schools teach is indifference. By bells and other concentration-destroying technology, schools teach that nothing is worth finishing because some arbitrary power intervenes both periodically and aperiodically. If nothing is worth finishing, nothing is worth starting. Don't you see how one follows the other? Love of learning can't survive this steady drill. Students are taught to work for little favors and ceremonial grades, which correlate poorly with their actual ability. By addicting children to outside approval and nonsense rewards, schools make them indifferent to the real power and potential that self-discovery reveals. Schools alienate the winners as well as the losers. 5. The fifth lesson schools teach is emotional dependency. By stars, checks, smiles, frowns, prizes, honors, and disgraces, schools condition children to lifelong emotional dependency. It's like training a dog. The reward-punishment cycle, known to animal trainers from antiquity, is the heart of a human psychology distilled in late 19th century Leipzig and incorporated thoroughly into the scientific management revolution of the early 20th century in America. Half a century later, by 1968, it had infected every school system in the United States, so all-pervasive at century's end that few people can imagine a different way to go about management. And indeed, there isn't a better one. If the goal of managed lives in a managed economy and a managed social order is what you're after. Each day, schools reinforce how absolute and arbitrary power really is by granting and denying access to fundamental needs for toilets, water, privacy, and movement. In this way, basic human rights, which usually require only individual volition, are transformed into privileges not to be taken for granted. 6. The sixth lesson schools teach is intellectual dependency. Good people wait for a teacher to tell them what to do. Good people do it the way the teacher wants it done. Good teachers, in their turn, wait for the curriculum supervisor or textbook to tell them what to do. Principals are evaluated according to their ability to make these groups conform to expectations, superintendents upon their ability to make principals conform, state education departments upon their ability to efficiently direct and control the thinking of superintendents according to instructions which originate with foundations, universities, and politicians sensitive to the quietly expressed wishes of powerful corporations and other interests. For all its clumsy execution, school is a textbook illustration of how the bureaucratic chain of command is supposed to work. Once the thing is running, virtually nobody can alter its direction who doesn't understand the complex code for making it work, a code that never stops trying to complicate itself further in order to make human control impossible. The sixth lesson of schooling teaches that experts make all important choices, but it is useless to remonstrate with the expert nearest you because he is as helpless as you are to change the system. The seventh lesson schools teach is provisional self-esteem. Self-respect in children must be made contingent on the certification of experts through rituals of number magic. It must not be self-generated as it was for Benjamin Franklin, the Wright brothers, Thomas Edison, or Henry Ford. The role of grades, report cards, standardized tests, prizes, scholarships, and other awards in affecting this process is too obvious to belabor. But it's the daily encounter with hundreds of verbal and nonverbal cues sent by teachers that shapes the quality of self-doubt most effectively. The last lesson school teaches I'll call the glass house effect. It teaches how hopeless it is to resist because you're always watched. There is no place to hide, nor should you want to. Your avoidance behavior is actually a signal you should be watched even more closely than the others. Privacy is a thought crime. School sees to it that there is no private time, no private space, no minute uncommanded, no desk free from search, no bruise not inspected by medical policing or the counseling arm of thought patrols. The most sensitive children I had each year knew on some level what was really going on. But we choked the treacherous breath out of them until they acknowledged they depended on us for their futures. Hardcore cases were remanded to adjustment agencies, where they converted themselves into manageable cynics. In the summer of 1997, a Democratic senator stood on the floor of the Senate denouncing the spread of what he called wacko algebra, one widely distributed math text referred to in that speech, did not ask a question requiring algebraic knowledge until page 107. What replaced the boredom of symbolic calculation were discussions of the role of Zoos in community life, or excursions to visiting the fascinating Dogon tribe of West Africa. Whatever your own personal attitude toward rainforest algebra, as it was snidely labeled, you would be hard-pressed not to admit one thing. Its problems are almost computation-free. Whether you find the mathematical side of social issues relevant or not isn't in question. Your attention should be fixed on the existence of minds, nominally in charge of number enlightenment for your children, which consider a private agenda more important than numbers. 1 week last spring, the entire math homework in fifth grade at middle class PS 87 on the Upper West Side of Manhattan consisted of two questions. 1. Historians estimate that when Columbus landed on what is now the island of Haiti, there were 250,000 people living there. In 2 years, this number had dropped to 125,000. What fraction of the people who had been living in Haiti when Columbus arrived remained? Why do you think the Arawaks died? Question 2. In 1515, there were only 50,000 Arawaks left alive. In 1550, there were 500. If the same number of people died each year, approximately how many people would have died each year? In 1550, what percentage of the original population was left alive? How do you feel about this? Tom Lovelace, the professor at the Kennedy School of Government at Harvard, has no doubt that the National Council of Teachers of Mathematics standards have deliberately de-emphasized math skills, and he knows precisely how it was done. But like other vigorous dissenters who have tried to arrest the elimination of critical intellect in children, he adduces no motive for the awesome project, which has worked so well up to now. Lovelace believes that the real reform project has begun, writing standards that declare the mathematics children will learn. He may be right, but I'm not so sanguine. Elsewhere, there are clues which should check premature optimism. In 1989, according to Lovelace, a group of experts in the field of math education launched a campaign to change the content and teaching of mathematics. This new math created state and district policies which tend to present math reform as religion and identify as sinful behaviors teacher-delivered instruction, individual student desk work, papers corrected for error. Teachers are ordered to keep an elaborate diary on each child's mathematical disposition. Specific skills de-emphasized are learning to use fractions, decimals, percents, integers, addition, subtraction, multiplication, division. All have given way to working with manipulatives like beans and counting sticks, much as the Arawaks themselves would have done, and with calculators. Parents worry themselves sick when fifth graders can't multiply 7 times 5 without hunting for beans and sticks. Students who learn the facts of math deep down in the bone, says Lovelace, gain a sense of number unfathomable to those who don't know them. The question critics should ask has nothing to do with computation or reading ability and everything to do with this. How does a fellow human being come to regard ordinary people's children as experimental animals? What impulse triggers the pornographic urge to deprive kids of volition, to fiddle with their lives? It is vital that you consider this, or you will certainly fall victim to appeals that you look at the worthiness of the outcome sought and ignore the methods. This appeal to pragmatism urges a repudiation of principle, sometimes even on the grounds that modern physics proves there is no objective reality. Whether children are better off or not, being spared the effort of thinking algebraically may well be a question worth debating, but if so, the burden of proof rests on the challenger. Short-circuiting the right to choice is a rapist's tactic or a seducer's. If behind a masquerade of number study, some unseen engineer infiltrates the inner layer of a kid's consciousness, the type of subliminal influence exerted in rainforest algebra, tinkering with the way a child sees the larger world, then in a literal sense the purpose of the operation is to dehumanize the experimental subject by forcing him or her into a predetermined consensus. True believers are only one component of American schooling. As a fraction, probably a small one, but they constitute a tail that wags the dog because they possess a blueprint and access to policy machinery, while most of the rest of us do not. The true believers we call great educators, Kamensky, Mather, Pestalozzi, Froebel, Mann, Dewey, Sears, Cubberley, Thorndike et al., were ideologues looking for a religion to replace one they never had or had lost faith in. As an abstract type, men like this have been analyzed by some of the finest minds in the history of modern thought, Machiavelli, Tocqueville, Renan, William James, to name a few. but the clearest profile of the type was set down by Eric Hoffer, a one-time migrant farm worker who didn't learn to read until he was 15 years old. In The True Believer, a luminous modern classic, Hoffer tells us, quote, "Though ours is a godless age, it is the very opposite of irreligious. The true believer is everywhere on the march, shaping the world in his own image. Whether we line up with him or against him, it is well we should know all we can concerning his nature and potentialities." Close quote. It looks to me as if the energy to run this train was released in America from the stricken body of New England Calvinism when its theocracy collapsed from indifference, ambition, and the hostility of its own children. At the beginning of the 19th century, shortly after we became a nation, this energy gave rise to what Alan Bloom dubbed the New American Religion, eventually combining elements of old Calvinism with flavors of Anabaptism, ranting, leveling, Quakerism, rationalism, positivism, and that peculiar Unitarian spice, scientism. Where the parent form of American Calvinism had preached the rigorous exclusion of all but a tiny handful deemed predestinated for salvation, the famous saints or justified sinners, the descendant faith, beginning about the time of the Great Awakening in the 1740s, demanded universal inclusion, recruitment of everyone into a universal Unitarian salvation, whether they would be so recruited or not. It was a monumental shift, which in time infiltrated every American institution. In its demand for eventual planetary unity, the operating logic of this hybrid religion, which derived from a medley of Protestant sects as well as from Judaism, in a cosmic irony, was intensely Catholic right down to its core. After the Unitarian takeover of Harvard in 1805, Orthodox Calvinism seemingly reached the end of its road, but so much explosive energy had been tightly bound into this intense form of sacred thought, an intensity which made every act, however small, brim with significance, every expression of personality proclaim an election or damnation, that in its structural collapse, a ferocious energy was released, a tornado that flashed across the burned-over district of upstate New York, crossing the lakes to Michigan and other Germanized outposts of North America, where it split suddenly into two parts, one racing westward to California and the Northwest Territories, another turning southwest to the Mexican colony called Texas. Along the way, Calvin's by now much-altered legacy deposited new religions like Mormonism and Seventh-day Adventism, raised colleges like the University of Michigan and Michigan State, which would later become fortresses of the new schooling religion, and left prisons, insane asylums, Indian reservations, and poorhouses in its wake as previews of the secularized global village it aimed to create. School was to be the temple of a new all-inclusive civil religion. Calvinism had stumbled, finally from being too self-contained. This new American form, learning from Calvinism's failure, aspired to become a multicultural super-system, world-girdling in the fullness of time. Our recent military invasions of Haiti, Panama, Iraq, the Balkans, and Afghanistan, redolent of the palmy days of British Empire, cannot be understood from the superficial justifications offered. Yet with an eye to Calvin's legacy, even foreign policy yields some of its secret springs. Calvinist origins armed schoolthinkers from the start with a utilitarian contempt for the notion of free will. Brain control experiments being explored in the psychophysical labs of northern Germany in the last quarter of the 19th century attracted rich young men from thousands of prominent American families. Such mind science seemed to promise that tailor-made technologies could emerge to shape and control thought, technologies which had never existed before. Children, the new psychology suggested, could be emptied, denatured, then reconstructed to more accommodating designs. H.G. Wells' Island of Dr. Moreau was an extrapolation fable based on common university-inspired drawing room conversations of the day. David Hume's empirical philosophy, working together with John Locke's empiricism, had prepared the way for social thinkers to see children as blank slates, an opinion predominant among influentials long before the Civil War, and implicit in Machiavelli, Bowdoin, and the Bacons. German psychophysics and physiological psychology seemed a wonderful manufactory of the tools a good political surgeon needed to make the modern world. Methods for modifying society and all its inhabitants began to crystallize from the insights of the laboratory. A good living could be made by saying it was so, even if it weren't true. When we examine the new American teacher college movement at the turn of the century, we discover a resurrection of the methodology of Prussian philosopher Herbart well underway. Although Herbart had been dead a long time by then, he had the right message for the new age. According to Herbart, children should be cut to fit. A bountiful source of clues to what tensions were actually at work back then can be found in Elwood P. Cubberley's celebratory history, Public Education in the United States, 1919, revised edition, 1934. The standard in-house reference for official school legends until revisionist writings appeared in the 1960s. Cubberley was an insider's insider, in a unique position to know things neither public nor press could know. Although Cubberley always is circumspect and deliberately vague, he cannot help revealing more than he wants to. For example, the reluctance of the country to accept its new yoke of compulsion is caught briefly in this flat statement on page 564 of the 1934 revision, quote, "The history of compulsory attendance legislation in the states has been much the same everywhere, and everywhere laws have been enacted only after overcoming strenuous opposition." Close quote. Reference here is to the period from 1852 to 1918, when the states one by one were caught in a compulsion net that used the strategy of gradualism. At first, the laws were optional. Later, the law was made statewide, but the compulsory period was short, 10 to 12 weeks, and the age limits low, 9 to 12 years. After this, struggle came to extend the time, often little by little, to extend the age limits downward to 8 and 7 and upwards to 14, 15, or 16, to make the law apply to children attending private or parochial schools, and to require cooperation from such schools for the proper handling of cases, to institute state supervision of local enforcement, to connect school attendance enforcement with the child labor legislation of the state through a system of working permits. Noteworthy is the extent to which proponents of centralized schooling were prepared to act covertly in defiance of majority will and in the face of extremely successful and inexpensive local school heritage. As late as 1901, after nearly half a century of such legislation, first in Massachusetts, then state by state in the majority of the remaining jurisdictions, Dr. Levi Seeley of Trenton Normal School could still thunder warnings of lack of progress. In his book, Foundations of Education, he writes, "While no law on the statute books of Prussia is more thoroughly carried out than compulsory attendance," he laments that in 1890, out of 5,300,000 Prussian children, only 645 slipped out of the truant officer's net, but that our own school attendance legislation is nothing more than dead-letter laws. "We have been attempting compulsory education for a whole generation and cannot be said to have made much progress. Let us cease to require only 20 weeks of schooling, 12 of which shall be consecutive, thus plainly hinting that we are not serious in the matter. Close quote. Seeley's frustration clouded his judgment. Somebody was most certainly serious about mass confinement schooling. To stay at it so relentlessly and expensively in the face of massive public repudiation of the scheme. The center of the scheme was Massachusetts, the closest thing to a theocracy to have emerged in America. The list below is a telling record of the long gap between the Massachusetts compulsory law of 1852 and similar legislation adopted by the next set of states. Instructive also in the chronology is the place taken by the District of Columbia, the seat of federal government. And here Agatto provides a list of states and dates, which is kind of tedious for radio reading, but it should be pointed out that the District of Columbia was the second area to adopt the compulsory school legislation. That was in 1865. Vermont followed in 1867. New York, Kansas, and California in 1874, with Ohio in 1877, and the Dakotas, Montana, Illinois, and Rhode Island in 1883. Six other western states and territories were added by 1890. Finally, in 1918, 66 years after the Massachusetts force legislation, the 48th state, Mississippi, enacted a compulsory school attendance law. Keep in mind Coverley's words. Everywhere there was strenuous opposition. But a strange thing happened as more and more children were drawn into the net, a crisis of an unexpected sort. At first, those primitive one-room and two-room compulsion schools, and even the large new secondary schools like Philadelphia Central High, poured out large numbers of trained, disciplined intellects. Government school teachers in those early days chose overwhelmingly to emulate the standards of private academies, and to a remarkable degree they succeeded in unwittingly sabotaging the hierarchical plan being moved in online. Without a carefully trained administrative staff, and most American schools had no administrators, it proved impossible to impose the dumbing-down process promised by the German prototype. In addition, right through the 1920s, a skilled apprenticeship alternative was active in the United States, traditional training that still honored our national mythology of success. Ironically, the first crisis provoked by the new school institution was taking its rhetorical mandate too seriously. From it poured an abundance of intellectually trained minds at exactly the moment when the national economy of independent livelihoods and democratic workplaces was giving way to professionally managed, accountant-driven, hierarchical corporations which needed no such people. The typical graduate of a one-room school represented a force antithetical to the logic of corporate life, a cohort inclined to judge leadership on its merit, one reluctant to confer authority on mere titles. Immediate action was called for. Coverley's celebratory history doesn't examine motives, but it does uneasily record forceful steps taken just inside the new century to nip the career of intellectual schooling for the masses in the bud, replacing it with a different goal, the forging of well-adjusted citizens. Quote, since 1900, and due more to the activity of persons concerned with social legislation and those interested in improving the moral welfare of children than to educators themselves, there has been a general revision of the compulsory education laws of our states and the enactment of much new child welfare and anti-child labor legislation. These laws have brought into the schools not only the truant and the incorrigible, who under former conditions either left early or were expelled, but also many children who have no aptitude for book learning and many children of inferior mental qualities who do not profit by ordinary classroom procedures. Our schools have come to contain many children who become a nuisance in the school and tend to demoralize school procedure. Close quote. We're not going to get much closer to running face-to-face into the true believers and the self-interested parties who imposed forced schooling than in Coverley's mysterious persons concerned with social legislation. At about the time Coverley refers to, Walter Jessup, president of the University of Iowa, was publicly complaining, quote, "Now America demands we educate the whole. It is a much more difficult problem to teach all children than to teach those who want to learn." Close quote. Common sense should tell you it isn't difficult to teach children who don't want to learn. It's impossible. Common sense should tell you America was demanding nothing of the sort, but somebody most certainly was insisting on universal indoctrination in class subordination. The forced attendance of children who want to be elsewhere, learning in a different way, meant the short, happy career of academic public schooling was deliberately foreclosed, with democracy used as the excuse. The new inclusive pedagogy effectively doomed the bulk of American children. What you should take away from this is the deliberate introduction of children who, quote, demoralized school procedure. Children who were accommodated prior to this legislation in a number of other productive and by no means inferior forms of training, just as Benjamin Franklin had been. Richard Hofstadter and other social historians have mistakenly accepted at face value official claims that democratic tradition, the will of the people, imposed this anti-intellectual diet on the classroom. Democracy had nothing to do with it. What we are up against is a strategic project supported by an uneasy coalition of elites, each with its own private goals in mind for the common institution. Among those goals was the urge to go to war against diversity, to impose orthodoxy on heterodox society. For an important clue to how this was accomplished, we return to Coverley. Quote, "The school reorganized its teaching along lines dictated by the new psychology of instruction which had come to us from abroad. Beginning about 1880 to 1885, our schools began to experience a new but steady change in purpose, though it is only since about 1900 that any marked and rapid changes have set in." Close quote. The new psychology of instruction cited here is the new experimental psychology of Wilhelm Wundt at Leipzig, which dismissed the very existence of mind as an epiphenomenon. Children were complex machines capable of infinite adjustments. Here was the beginning of that new and unexpected genus of schooling which Balin said troubled well-disposed high-minded people, and which elevated a new class of technocrat like Coverley and Dewey to national prominence. The intention to sell schooling as a substitute for faith is caught clearly in Coverley's observation, quote, "However much we have lost interest in the old problems of faith and religion, the American people have come to believe thoroughly in education." Close quote. New subjects replace the old limited book subject curriculum, both elementary and secondary. This was done despite the objections of many teachers and citizens and much ridicule from the public press. Many spoke sneeringly of the new subjects. Coverley provides an accurate account of the prospective new city on the hill for which public education was to be a prelude, a city which rose hurriedly after the failed populist revolt of 1896 frightened industrial leaders. I've selected 6 excerpts from Coverley's celebrated history, which will allow you to see, through an insider's eyes, the game that was afoot a century ago, as U.S. school training was being fitted for its German uniform. 1. The Spanish-American War of 1898 served to awaken us as a nation. It revealed to us something of the position we should be called to occupy in world affairs. And just a reminder, he's quoting from Cubberley. This is not Gatto's opinion. The second excerpt from Cubberley. For the two decades following, the specialization of labor and the introduction of labor-saving machinery took place to an extent before unknown. The national and state government were called upon to do many things for the benefit of the people never attempted before. And next, since 1898, education has awakened a public interest before unknown. Everywhere, state educational commissions and city school surveys have evidenced a new critical attitude. Much new educational legislation has been enacted. Permission has been changed to obligation. Minimum requirements have been laid down by the states in many new directions, and new subjects of instruction have been added by the law. Courses of study have been entirely made over, and new types of textbooks have appeared. A complete new system of industrial education, national in scope, has been developed. And new normal schools have been founded and higher requirements have been ordered for those desiring to teach. College departments of education have increased from 11 in 1891 to something like 500 today, 1919. Private gifts to colleges and universities have exceeded anything known before in any land. School taxes have been increased, old school funds more carefully guarded, and new constitutional provisions as to education have been added. Compulsory education has begun to be a reality, and child labor laws to be enforced. A new interest in child welfare and child hygiene has arisen, evidencing commendable desire to look after the bodies as well as the minds of children. Close quote. That from Cubberley. Now back to Gatto. Here, in a brief progression, is one window on the problem of modern schooling. It set out to build a new social order at the beginning of the 20th century, and by 1970 had succeeded beyond all expectations. But in the process, it crippled the democratic experiment of America, disenfranchising ordinary people, dividing families, creating wholesale dependencies, grotesquely extending childhoods. It emptied people of full humanity in order to convert them into human resources. If you have a hard time believing that this revolution and the contract ordinary Americans had with their political state was intentionally provoked, it's time for you to meet William Torrey Harris, U.S. Commissioner of Education from 1889 to 1906. No one other than Cubberley, who rose out of the ranks of professional pedagogues, ever had as much influence as Harris. Harris both standardized and Germanized our schools. Listen to his voice from The Philosophy of Education, published in 1906. Quote, 99 students out of 100 are automata, careful to walk in prescribed paths, careful to follow the prescribed custom. This is not an accident, but the result of substantial education, which, scientifically defined, is the subsumption of the individual. Listen to Harris again, giant of American schooling, leading scholar of German philosophy in the Western Hemisphere, editor and publisher of the Journal of Speculative Philosophy, which trained a generation of American intellectuals in the ideas of the Prussian thinkers Kant and Hegel, the man who gave America scientifically age-graded classrooms to replace successful mixed-age school practice. Again, from The Philosophy of Education, Harris sets forth his gloomy vision. Quote, the great purpose of school can be realized better in dark, airless, ugly places. It is to master the physical self, to transcend the beauty of nature. School should develop the power to withdraw from the external world. Close quote. Nearly 100 years ago, this schoolman thought self-alienation was the secret to successful industrial society. Surely he was right. When you stand at a machine or sit at a computer, you need an ability to withdraw from life to alienate yourself without a supervisor. How else could that be tolerated unless prepared in advance by simulated Birkenhead drills? School, thought Harris, was sensible preparation for a life of alienation. Can you say he was wrong? In exactly the years Cubberley of Stanford identified as the launching time for the school institution, Harris reigned supreme as the bull-goose educator of America. He was the most influential voice teaching what school was to be in a modern scientific state. School histories commonly treat Harris as an old-fashioned defender of high academic standards, but this analysis is grossly inadequate. Stemming from his philosophical alignment with Hegel, Harris believed that children were property and that the state had a compelling interest in disposing of them as it pleased. Some would receive intellectual training, most would not. Any distinction that can be made between Harris and later weak curriculum advocates, those interested in stupefaction for everybody, is far less important than substantial agreements in both camps that parents or local tradition could no longer determine the individual child's future. Unlike any official schoolman until Conant, Harris had social access to important salons of power in the United States. Over his long career, he furnished inspiration to the ongoing obsessions of Andrew Carnegie, the steel man who first nourished the conceit of yoking our entire economy to cradle-to-grave schooling. If you can find copies of The Empire of Business, published in 1902, or Triumphant Democracy from 1886, you will find remarkable congruence between the world Carnegie urged and the one our society has achieved. Carnegie's gospel of wealth idea took his peers by storm at the very moment the great school transformation began. The idea that the wealthy owed society a duty to take over everything in the public interest was an uncanny echo of Carnegie's experience as a boy watching the elite establishment of Britain and the teachings of its state religion. It would require perverse blindness not to acknowledge a connection between the Carnegie blueprint, hammered into shape in the Greenwich Village salon of Mrs. Botta after the Civil War, and the explosive developments which restored the Anglican worldview to our schools. Of course, every upper class in history has specified what can be known. The defining characteristic of class control is its establishment of a grammar and vocabulary for ordinary people, and for subordinate elites, too. If the rest of us uncritically accept certain official concepts such as, quote, globalization, then we have unwittingly committed ourselves to a whole intricate narrative of society's future, too, a narrative which inevitably drags an irresistible curriculum in its wake. Since Aristotle, thinkers have understood that work is the vital theater of self-knowledge. Schooling, in concert with a controlled workplace, is the most effective way to foreclose the development of imagination ever devised. But where did these radical doctrines of true belief come from? Who spread them? We get at least part of the answer from the tantalizing clue Walt Whitman left when he said, "Only Hegel is fit for America." Hegel was the protean Prussian philosopher capable of shaping Karl Marx on one hand and J.P. Morgan on the other, the man who taught a generation of prominent Americans that history itself could be controlled by the deliberate provoking of crises. Hegel was sold to America in large measure by William Torrey Harris, who made Hegelianism his lifelong project. and forced schooling its principal instrument in its role as an unrivaled agent provocateur. Harris was inspired by the notion that correctly managed mass schooling would result in a population so dependent on leaders that schism and revolution would be things of the past. If a world state could be cobbled together by Hegelian tactical manipulation and such a school plan imposed upon it, history itself would stop. No more wars, no civil disputes, just people waiting around pleasantly like the Eloi in Wells' The Time Machine, waiting for teacher to tell them what to do. The psychological tool was alienation. The trick was to alienate children from themselves so they couldn't turn inside for strength. To alienate them from their families, religions, cultures, etc., so that no countervailing force could intervene. Carnegie used his own considerable influence to keep this expatriate New England Hegelian the U.S. Commissioner of Education for 16 years, long enough to set the stage for an era of, quote, scientific management, or Fordism, as the Soviets called it in American schooling, long enough to bring about the rise of the multi-layered school bureaucracy. But it would be a huge mistake to regard Harris and other true believers as merely tools of business interests. What they were about was the creation of a modern living faith to replace the Christian one which had died for them. It was their good fortune to live at precisely the moment when the dreamers of the empire of business, to use Emperor Carnegie's label, for an Anglo-American world state, were beginning to consider worldwide schooling as the most direct route to that destination. Both movements, to centralize the economy and to centralize schooling, were aided immeasurably by the rapid disintegration of old-line Protestant churches and the rise from their pious ashes of the social gospel ideology, aggressively underwritten by important industrialists who intertwined church-going tightly with standards of business, entertainment, and government. The experience of religion came to mean, in the words of Reverend Earl Hoon, the best social programs money can buy. A clear statement of the belief that social justice and salvation were to be had through skillful consumption. Shaler Matthews, Dean of Chicago's School of Divinity, editor of Biblical World, president of the Federal Council of Churches, wrote his influential Scientific Management in the Churches of 1912 to convince American Protestants they should sacrifice independence and autonomy and adopt the structure and strategy of corporations. Quote, if this seems to make the church something of a business establishment, it is precisely what should be the case, close quote. If Americans listened to the corporate message, Matthews told them, they would feel anew the spell of Jesus. In the decade before World War I, a consortium of private foundations, drawing on industrial wealth, began slowly working toward a long-range goal of lifelong schooling and a thoroughly rationalized global economy and society. Frances Fitzgerald, in her superb study of American textbooks, America Revised, notes that school books are superficial and mindless, that they deliberately leave out important ideas, that they refuse to deal with conflict, but then she admits to bewilderment. What could be the plan behind such texts? Is the composition of these books accidental or deliberate? Sidestepping an answer to her own question, Fitzgerald traces the changeover to a pair of influential NEA reports published in 1911 and 1918, which reversed the scholarly determinations of the Blue Ribbon Committee of Ten report of 1893. That committee laid down a rigorous academic program for all schools and for all children, giving particular emphasis to history. It asserted, the purpose of all education is to train the mind, close quote. The NEA reports of 1911 and 1918 denote a conscious abandonment of this intellectual imperative and the substitution of some very different guiding principles. These statements savagely attack the, quote, bookish curricula, which are responsible for leading tens of thousands of boys and girls away from pursuits for which they are adapted toward pursuits for which they are not, like independent businesses, invention, white-collar work, or the professions. Books give children, quote, false ideals of culture. These reports urge the same kinds of drill which lay at the core of Prussian commoner schools. An interim report of 1917 also proposes that emphasis be shifted away from history to something safer called social studies, the thrust away from any careful consideration of the past, so that attention might be focused on the future. That 1918 NEA report, Cardinal Principles of Secondary Education, for all its maddening banality, was to prove over time one of the most influential education documents of the 20th century. It decreed that specified behaviors, health, and vocational training were the central goals of education, not mental development, not character, not godliness. Fitzgerald wrote she could not find a name for the ideology that lies behind these texts. The way they handle history, for instance, is not history at all, but a catechism of American socialist realism. More than once she notes, quote, actual hostility to the notion of intellectual training. Passion, in partnership with impatience for debate, is one good sign of the presence of true belief. The most visible clue to the degree true belief was at work in mass schooling in the early decades of this century is the National Education Association's 1918 policy document, written entirely in the strange narcotic diction and syntax of official pedagogy, which makes it almost impenetrable to outsiders. Cardinal Principles announces a new de-intellectualized curriculum to replace the famous recipe for high goals and standards laid out three decades earlier by the legendary Committee of Ten, which declared the purpose of all education to be the training of the mind. This new document contradicted its predecessor. In a condemnation worth repeating, it accused the Older Testament of forcing impossible intellectual ambitions on common children, of turning their empty heads, giving them false ideals of culture. The weight of such statements, full of assumptions and implications, cannot easily be felt through its abstract language. But if you recognize that its language conceals a mandate for the mass dumbing down of young Americans, then some understanding of the magnitude of the successful political coup which had occurred comes through to penetrate the fog. The repudiation of the Committee of Ten was reinforced by a companion report proposing that history, economics, and geography be dropped at once. What Cardinal Principles gave proof of was that the stage one of a silent revolution in American society was complete. Children could now be taught anything, or even taught nothing, in the part-time prisons of schooling, and there was little any individual could do about it. Bland generalities in the document actually served as potent talismans to justify the engineering of stupefaction. Local challenges could be turned back, local challengers demonized and marginalized, just by waving the national standards of cardinal principles as proof of one's legitimacy. Venal motives, as well as ideological ones, were served by the comprehensive makeover of schooling, and palms incidentally greased in the transition soon found themselves defending it for their own material advantage. Schools quickly became the largest jobs project in the country, an enormous contractor for goods and services, one always willing to pay top dollar for bottom shelf merchandise, in a dramatic reversal of economic theory. There are no necessary economies in large-scale purchasing. School is proof of that. Cardinal principles assured mass production technocrats they would not have to deal with intolerable numbers of independent thinkers, thinkers stuffed with dangerous historical comparisons, who understood economics, who had insight into human nature through literary studies, who were made stoical or consensus-resistant by philosophy and religion, and given confidence and competence through liberal doses of duty, responsibility, and experience. The appearance of cardinal principles signaled the triumph of forces which had been working since the 1890s to break the hold of complex reading, debate, and writing as the common heritage of children reared in America. Like the resourcefulness and rigors of character that small farming conveyed, complex and active literacy produces a kind of character antagonistic to hierarchical, expert-driven, class-based society. As the nature of American society was moved deliberately in this direction, forges upon which a different kind of American had been hammered were eliminated. We see this process nearly complete in the presentation of cardinal principles. We always knew the truth in America, that almost everyone can learn almost anything or be almost anything. But the problem with that insight is that it can't coexist with any known form of modern social ordering. Each species of true belief expresses some social vision or another, some holy way to arrange relationships, time, values, etc., in order to drive forward a settlement of the great question, why are we alive? The trouble with a society which encourages argument, as America's did until the mid-20th century, is that there is no foreseeable end to the argument, no way to lock the door and announce that your own side has finally won, no certainty. Our most famous true believers, the Puritans, thought they could build a city on the hill and keep the riffraff out. When it became obvious that exclusion wasn't going to work, their children and grandchildren did an about-face and began to move toward a totally inclusive society, though not a free one. It would be intricately layered into social classes like the old British system. This time, God's will wouldn't be offered as reason for the way things were arranged by men. This time, science and mathematics would justify things, and children would be taught to accept the inevitability of their assigned fates in the greatest laboratory of true belief ever devised, the compulsion schoolhouse. One man left us a dynamic portrait of the great school project prematurely completed in miniature. William James, an insider's insider, foremost and first psychologist of America, brother of novelist Henry James. James Prestige is a formidable Boston Brahmin launched American psychology. Without him, it's touch and go whether it would have happened at all. His Varieties of Religious Experience is unique in the American literary canon. No wonder John Dewey dropped Hegel and Herbart after a brief flirtation with the Germans and attached himself to James and his philosophy of pragmatism, which is the Old Norse religion brought up to date. But James was too deep a thinker to believe his own screed fully. In a little book called Talks to Teachers, which remains in print today over 100 years after it was written, James disclosed his ambivalence about the ultimate dream of schooling in America. It was no Asiatic urge to enslave, no Midas fantasy of unlimited wealth, no conspiracy of class warfare, but only the dream of a comfortable, amusing world for everyone. The closest thing to an Augustan pastoral you could imagine, the other side of the British imperial coin. England's William Morris and John Ruskin, and perhaps Thomas Carlyle, were the literary godfathers of this dream society to come, a society already realized in a few cloistered spots on earth, on certain great English estates, and at the mother center of the Chautauqua movement in western New York. In 1899, James spoke to an idealistic new brigade of teachers recruited by Harvard, Men and women, meant to inspire the new institution, then rising swiftly from the ashes of the older neighborhood schools, private schools, church schools, and home schools. He spoke to the teachers of the dream that the entire planet could be transformed into a vast Chautauqua. Before you hear what he had to say, you need to know a little about Chautauqua. On August 10, 1878, John H. Vincent announced his plan for the formation of a study group to undertake a 4-year program of guided reading for ordinary citizens. The Chautauqua Literary and Scientific Circle signed up 200 people in its first hour, 8,400 by year's end. 10 years later, enrollment had grown to 100,000. At least that many more had completed the 4 years or fallen out after trying. In an incredibly short period of time, every community in the United States had somebody in it following the Chautauqua Reading Program. One of its teachers, Melville Dewey, developed the Dewey Decimal System, still in use in libraries. The reading list was ambitious. It included Greene's Short History of the English People, full of specific information about the original Anglo-Saxon tribes and their child-rearing customs, details which proved strikingly similar to the habits of upper-class Americans. Another Chautauqua text, Mahaffey's Old Greek Life, dealt with the utopia of classical Greece. It showed how civilization could only rise on the backs of underclass drudges. Many motivations to go Chautauqua existed. Love of learning, the social urge to work together, the thrill of competition in the race for honorary seals and diplomas which testified to a course completed, the desire to keep up with neighbors. The Chautauqua movement gave settlers of the Midwest and Far West a common Anglo-German intellectual heritage to link up with. This grassroots vehicle of popular education offered illustrations of principles to guide anyone through any difficulty. And in Chautauqua, New York itself, at the Mother Center, a perfect jewel of a rational utopia was taking shape, attended by the best and brightest minds in American society. You'll see it in operation just ahead with its soda pop fountains and model secondary schools. The great driving force behind Chautauqua in its early years was William Rainey Harper, a Yale graduate with a Ph.D. in philology, a man expert in ancient Hebrew, a prominent Freemason. Harper attracted a great deal of attention in his Chautauqua tenure. He would have been a prominent name on the national scene for that alone, even without his connection to the famous publishing family. John Vincent, Chautauqua's founder, had been struck by the vision of a world college described in Bacon's Utopia, one crowded and bustling with international clientele and honored names as faculty. Quote, Chautauqua will exalt the profession of teacher until the highest genius, the richest scholarship, and the broadest manhood and womanhood of the nation are consecrated to this service, close quote, Vincent once said. His explanation of the movement. We expect the work of Chautauqua will be to arouse so much interest in the subject of general liberal education that by and by in all quarters young men and women will be seeking to obtain such education in established resident institutions. Our diploma, though radiant with 31 seals, shields, stars, octagons, would not stand for much at Heidelberg, Oxford, or Harvard. An American curiosity, it would be respected not as conferring honor upon its holder, but as indicating a popular movement in favor of higher education. Close quote. Chautauqua's leaders felt their institution was a way station in America's progress to something higher. By 1886, Chautauqua was well known all over. The new University of Chicago, which Harper took over 5 years later, was patterned on the Chautauqua system, which in turn was superimposed over the logic of the German research university. together with Columbia Teachers College, Yale, Michigan, Wisconsin, Stanford, and a small handful of others, Chicago would provide the most important visible leadership for American public school policy well into the 20th century. At the peak of its popularity, 8,000 American communities subscribed to Chautauqua's programmatic evangelism. The many tent circuit Chautauquas simultaneously operating presented locals with the latest ideas in social progress, concentrating on self-improvement and social betterment through active reform with a capital R. But in practice, entertainment often superseded educational values because the temptation to hype the box office draw was insidious. Over time, progress came to be illustrated dramatically for maximum emotional impact. Audience reactions were then studied centrally, and adjustments were made in upcoming shows using what had been learned. What began as an education ended as show business. Its legacy is all over modern schooling in its spurious concept of motivation. Tent Chautauqua did a great deal to homogenize the United States as a nation. It brought to the attention of America an impressive number of new ideas and concepts, always from a management perspective. What seemed even-handed was seldom that. The classic problem of ethical teaching is how to avoid influencing an audience to think a certain way by use of psychological trickery. In this, Chautauqua failed. But even a partial list of developments credited to Chautauqua is impressive evidence of the influence of this early mass communication device, a harbinger of days ahead. We have Chautauqua to thank, in some important part, for the graduated income tax, for slum clearance as a business opportunity, juvenile courts, the school lunch program, free textbooks, a, quote, balanced diet, physical fitness, the campfire girls, the Boy Scout movement, pure food laws, and much, much more. One of the most popular Chautauqua speeches was titled Responsibilities of the American Citizen. The greatest responsibility was to listen to national leaders and get out of the way of progress. Ideas presented during Chautauqua Week were argued and discussed after the tents were gone. The most effective kind of indoctrination, according to letters which passed among Chautauqua's directors, is always self-inflicted. In the history of American orthodoxies, Chautauqua might seem a quaint sort of villain, but that's because technology soon offered a way through radio to Chautauqua on a grander scale, to Chautauqua simultaneously from coast to coast. Radio inherited Tent Chautauqua, presenting us with model heroes and families to emulate, teaching us all to laugh and cry the same way. The great dream of utopians, that we all behave alike like bees in a hive or ants in a hill, was brought close by Chautauqua, closer by radio, even closer by television, and to the threshold of universal reality by the World Wide Web. The chapter in 19th century history which made Chautauqua the harbinger of the new United States is not well enough appreciated. Ideas like evolution, German military tactics, Froebel's kindergartens, Hegelian philosophy, cradle-to-grave schooling, and systems of complete medical policing were all grist for Chautauqua's mill. Nothing was too esoteric to be popularized for a mass audience by the circuit of Tent Chautauqua. But above all, Chautauqua loved science. Science was the commodity it retailed most energetically, a new religion for a new day. The Chautauqua operation had been attractively planned and packaged by a former president of Masonic College, Georgia, William Rainey Harper, a man whose acquaintance you made on the previous page. Dr. Harper left Chautauqua eventually to become Rockefeller's personal choice to head up a new German-style research university Rockefeller brought into being in 1890, the University of Chicago. He would eventually become an important early patron of John Dewey and other leading lights of pedagogy. but his first publicly acclaimed triumph was Chautauqua. Little is known of his work at Masonic College. Apparently, it was impressive enough to bring him to the attention of the most important Freemasons in America. The real Chautauqua was not the peripatetic tent version, but a beautiful Disney-like world on a lake in upstate New York. William James went for a day to lecture at Chautauqua and stayed for a week to marvel and learn. His exact words of self-introduction to those teachers he spoke to long ago at Harvard. What he saw at Chautauqua was the ultimate realization of all reasonable thought solidified into one perfect working community. Utopia for real. Here it is as James remembered it for students and teachers. A few summers ago, I spent a happy week at the famous assembly grounds on the borders of Chautauqua Lake. The moment one treads that sacred enclosure, one feels oneself in an atmosphere of success. Sobriety and industry, intelligence and goodness, orderliness and reality, prosperity and cheerfulness pervade the air. It is a serious and studious picnic on a gigantic scale. Here you have a town of many thousands of inhabitants beautifully laid out in the forest and drained, and equipped with means for satisfying all the necessary lower and most of the superfluous higher wants of man. You have a first-class college in full blast. You have magnificent music, a chorus of 700 voices, with possibly the most perfect open-air auditorium in the world. You have every sort of athletic exercise from sailing, rowing, swimming, bicycling, to the ball field and the more artificial doings the gymnasium affords. You have kindergarten and model secondary schools. You have general religious services and special clubhouses for the several sects. You have perpetually running soda water fountains and daily popular lectures by distinguished men. You have the best of company and yet no effort. You have no diseases, no poverty, no drunkenness, no crime, no police. You have culture, you have kindness, you have equality, you have the best fruits of what mankind has fought and bled and striven for under the name of civilization for centuries. You have, in short, a foretaste of what human society might be were it all in the light with no suffering and dark corners, close quote. Flickering around the edges of James' description is a dawning consciousness that something is amiss. Like those suspicious of some innocent character on an old Twilight Zone show, it's so peaceful, so pretty, and clean. It looks like harmony, but I just have this terrible feeling that something is wrong. When James left Chautauqua, he realized that he had seen spread before him the realization on a sample scale of all of the ideals for which a scientific civilization strives, intelligence, humanity, and order. Then why his violently hostile reaction? What a relief, he said, to be out of there. There was no sweat, he continued disdainfully, in this unspeakable Chautauqua. No sight of the everlasting battle of the powers of light with those of darkness. No heroism, no struggle, no strength, no strenuousness. James cried aloud for the sight of the human struggle, and in a fit of pessimism he said to the school teachers, quote, "An irremediable flatness is coming over the world. Bourgeoisie and mediocrity, church sociables and teachers' conventions are taking the place of the old heights and depths. The whole world, delightful and sinful as it may still appear for a moment to one just escaped from the Chautauquan enclosure, is nevertheless obeying more and more just those ideals, sure to make of it, in the end, a mere Chautauqua assembly on an enormous scale." Close quote. A mere Chautauqua assembly? Is that all this monument to intelligence and order adds up to? Realizing the full horror of this country's first theme park, James would seem to have experienced an epiphany. Quote, "The scales seemed to fall from my eyes, and a wave of sympathy greater than anything I had ever before felt with the common life of common men began to fill my soul. It began to seem as if virtue with horny hands and dry skin were the only virtue genuine and vital enough to take account of. Every other virtue poses. None is absolutely unconscious and simple, unexpectant of decoration or recognition like this. These are our soldiers, I thought. These are our sustainers. These are the very parents of our lives." Close quote. Near the end of his life, James finally understood what the trap was. An overvaluation placed on order, rational intelligence, humanism, and material stuff of all sorts. The search for a material paradise is a flight away from humanity into the sterile non-life of mechanisms where everything is perfect until it becomes junk. At the end of 1997, Chautauqua was back in the news. A young man living there had deliberately infected at least 9 girls in the small town adjoining, and perhaps as many as 28 with AIDS. He picked out most of his victims from the local high school, looking for, as he put it, young ladies in a risk-taking mode. A monster like this AIDS predator could turn up anywhere naturally, but I was struck by the irony that he had found the very protected lakeside hamlet with its quaint 19th-century buildings and antique shops, this idyllic spot where so many of the true beliefs of rationality made their American debut, as a place to encounter women unprepared to know the ways of the human heart. In a risk-taking mode, as he puts it in instructively sociological jargon. Have over 100 years of the best rational thinking and innovation the Western world can muster made no other impact on the Chautauqua area than to set up its children to be preyed upon? A columnist for a New York paper, writing about the tragedy, argued that condom distribution might have helped, apparently unaware that the legitimization of birth control devices in the United States was just one of many achievements claimed by Chautauqua. Other remarks the reporter made were more to the point of why we need to be skeptical whether any kind of schooling, and Chautauqua's was the best human ingenuity could offer, is sufficient to make good people or good places. Quote, "The area has troubles and social problems of everywhere. Its kids are lonely in a crowd, misunderstood, beyond understanding and seeking love, as the song says, in all the wrong places. Once intact families, tightly knit neighborhoods, and stay-at-home mothers enforced community norms. Now, the world is the mall, mothers work, and community exists in daytime television and online chat rooms." Close quote.